Well, first of all, I was looking into the questions, and some of the questions will be answered actually on the way of going on with the teaching. So it's not helpful to take them already now. Some other questions have to do with the elections. And I wish I would know the Lord's mind in this. And but one thing I know, whatever it will happen, God is going to use it. And because he is the one who ordains kings and he uses them, no matter who is going to at the end come to power. In our human understanding, there are some better than others, but even then we are not really sure if they really are better. And the latest, maybe you have more news than I do, the latest what I still know is that Paris has to decide who's going to get the mandate to form a coalition, cabinet, and I didn't hear if he gave it to Livni or Netanyahu, which I personally think, yeah.
He can't do it on Wednesday. The final result's not coming until Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he actually, because it was so close, that I think he may end up to ask Netanyahu to build a coalition very simply for, because the right parties all together have more seats than the left parties all together, so they may, already now they may have 65 or even more seats, and living it will be very difficult for her to form a coalition with, even if she would take in also the Arab parties and so on, it will not be enough. That's why even Kadima may have a little bit more than Likud. Peres may ask still Netanyahu to build a coalition because... So, but I have even to say, even if Netanyahu will be prime minister, humanly speaking, he's a stronger leader than Livni. He, that's for sure, he understands the Middle East deeper, and he may stand much firmer towards Obama and others, that's no doubt. On the other hand, I have also to admit, on personal level, we have to say that Livni, she has more integrity as a human being than he has. At least she was showing more integrity as in her former behavior. She did not bow to the Orthodox pressure, for instance. That's why she's very hated by the spiritual leader of Shas, and he called not to vote for her. So, on the other hand, I think she... To be prime minister, I don't think that she has enough experience in the context. She's too humanistic concerning the Islamic world. She really believes that she can negotiate. And I think she has tremendous goodwill. There's no doubt. But humanly speaking, Israel needs today also a strong man who is willing not to bow. And we hope Netanyahu will not bow. But at the end, looking back to history, he was the one who gave away Hebron. And actually, it was almost always the right governments who made compromises. I mean, Begin gave away the Sinai, and so you can never tell. And again, whoever is going to become prime minister, I believe God is going to use it to bring Israel more to the place where Israel maybe start to recognize that the only help comes from God. And I'm expecting personally the pressure actually to increase over Israel, especially with Obama being president. We will not have easy days ahead of us. And so we have much more to intercede that God is going to have mercy and use whoever is going to come to power. Because to put our trust in the ability of the politician would not help much. Because right now I don't see anyone who is really able, strong enough, and have enough integrity to be a leader really to help Israel out of crisis which we are in. Most of the people, they don't have really much hope. There's a tremendous hopelessness and also fear. And we had so much corruption in the government that trust in the leadership is in Israel very weak. Let's pray that God is going to use that to open up the hearts of the people, to realize that Israel has no other helper, no other king than the Lord himself. And we will see. One thing we know, God is going to fulfill his promises. Even we can't tell how. And we are praying that God will also open up a door for believers into the Knesset. Actually, there are possible people who could. Maybe tomorrow, I'm going to tell you tomorrow morning, I will speak a little bit about the Messianic Body, what we are going through, that you may be equipped to pray better for the body. And I think that's something very, very important, that to invest prayer, that the Messianic Body will be strengthened, will really raise to be a light to this nation, all the different levels of society, and even into politics. Why not? Yeah. So, other questions? Maybe one question I have to answer, because this question always appears. And I understand also when people ask, is Allah the same God as the God of the Bible? Or can you, for instance, when a Muslim comes to the Lord, can he continue to pray to Allah? You see, here is, I would say, a little misunderstanding. Friends, do you think that the name, the English name God, is biblical? Why do you use it all the time? I think it's important to understand there is only one God. And the question is not what name this God has. The question is, how did he reveal himself? And we all believe the only revelation of God, the true revelation, is Yeshua. Yeshua, he is the revelation of the living God. That's what he says, who sees me, he sees the Father. And that's why he says, I am the light, the truth, I'm the way, the life, and the truth. So important is not if you call God Allah or God or Elohim. The importance is, how did this God reveal himself? And we know the God of Israel revealed himself in Yeshua. There's no other way to see him, to understand him, to relate to him than in and through Yeshua. Now, can a Muslim pray to Allah? If he prays to Allah in the name of Yeshua, yes, you know what? The Arabic Bible, who Arab Christian reads day by day, they read in their Bible Allah. Because Allah is the only name for God in Arabic. So, the name Allah itself is not the problem. The problem is that the Quran speaks about God, which in Arabic is called Allah, the way the Quran does. And that's a lie. God did not reveal himself through Muhammad. He revealed himself through Yeshua. And so we have to be very careful. If you would go to Arab Christian and tell them, you know, you can't use the name Allah because that's demonic, it will be very difficult for them because that's their language. So is Allah the same God? That's not the question. Question is always, how did God reveal himself? Because without Yeshua, we have no idea who God is. By the way, even the Hebrew name, we cannot really say. Because we say Yahweh, but Yahweh is not really the right expression. We have from the Tanakh, from the Bible, we have only the letters, which no one knows how to pronounce. Why? Because in Judaism you cannot say the name of God. If you say, then you say Hashem, it means the name. That's how in Judaism you refer to God. So you can even there not say what is the name. And rightly so, because God can only be understood in the Messiah, because he is the revelation of God. So don't try to get hard on Arabs who pray to Allah in the name of Yeshua, because that's the only way they can. If you take this away from them, they have no name for God. Now, maybe to help you a little bit in this is also, Allah in Arabic comes from the Arabic Al-Ilah, it means the God. And when Muhammad started with his, with developing Islam, I said there were hundreds of gods. For instance, around the shrine of Mecca, there were 300 different idols there. Even images from Mary and Jesus and all that. But even in the time before Islam, they had a name for a God who was over all the other gods. You can compare that to the unknown God in Athena, where Paul said, you have an altar for the unknown God. Something like that existed even in the polytheistic religion among the Arabs. And they called him the God, Al-Ilah. And out of this developed actually the name Allah. So Muhammad was speaking about the God who was over everything. And so today, in Arabic language, for God, does only the name Allah, exists only the name Allah. You can say Ar-Rab, it means the Lord. But again, Arab Christian used the name Allah long, long before New Zealand ever heard something about Jesus. You know, many Christian don't know that the Arabic church is much, much older than the church in the West. You know, when in the time where in Britain and other places people are still were dancing around the trees, they were old Arab churches already in the Middle East. And they had only one word for God, and this was Allah. So I hope that would help you just to be careful in this area. More important to ask about Jesus, because he is the one who makes the difference. So we have the election, we have this one, and other things, other question will be answered, I think, while I'm going on. Well, there are things like, what did the millions given to Arafat go? I would like to know that too. But few things will be answered again. Okay, I suggest that I'm going to first continue a little bit, and then if you still have a question, then we'll come back. Do you remember where I stopped? Terrorism, exactly. I was talking about the strategy of Osama bin Laden and all the movements who are somehow inspired by him or connected with him. There are many other movements who are not Al-Qaeda but still inspired. And actually not inspired by him only, but inspired to go back to their roots, and they went back and came up with clear determination and understanding how to deal with the West. Coming back to Osama's strategy, I spoke about one thing, how actually Islam started to get more and more respected in the West, and given more influence into the Western society. That's one thing, out of the fear that Muslims will not be some in the West, in Europe and in the States and so on, that they will not be pushed to become extreme, radical. And another part of the strategy is Osama bin Laden and these people, they understood that if they push hard, if they let the West understand, we don't have nothing which is we commit ourselves to, We have our own rules and regulation. We don't accept your human rights, whatever. We have our own. And we're going to attack you whenever we want, and you cannot control that. They know that the West is going to do everything not to provoke them. Not to provoke. And I remember during the Lebanon War, I was traveling, as I said yesterday, in Europe, and saw how the strategy actually really started to, what a success was a success for these people, because out of the fear that the Muslim could be provoked and start to attack much more, the Europeans and the West would not only start to negotiate with them, to give in demands, to allow Islam really to develop in the West, but they will start more and more to actually cultivate an attitude towards Israel, because Israel is Israel actually is to blame for the aggression, for the anger Muslims have. And Osama bin Laden understood that if the Europeans have to choose between their own skin and the skin of the Jews, the choice will be very simple. So if they have to decide where the bombs should fall, then it will be very simple. He understood that if people fear for their life, for their own life, if you hit them directly, if the war is not something happening somewhere else, but it happens on their own homes, on their doorsteps, and they, as normal people, are affected by it, then there will be a change. Then they will start to put pressure on their governments. They will start to cry out, stop the Jews, because they actually are the reason why Muslims are angry and why we are targeted. And the Jews actually are a danger to our existence. And Osama bin Laden knew that at the end, what he can do is, because he cannot fight Israel itself, he can raise anti-Semitism in the world, and the world is going to start to turn against Israel, and the world at least start to back off supporting Israel. By the way, something which everybody can see today, I'm going to speak a little bit about Iran later, but just to take something in this context, what Ahmadinejad does today, it's actually unbelievable. All the West is listening and nobody does anything. What he says, in Europe you would be put in jail. Here is a leader, a part of the UN, and he calls officially for the destruction of a state. Not only that he denies Holocaust and all that, and he does it and nobody really intervenes or cares. No leader. Well, people may say, well, he's not, you know, he's a little bit insane. You know, he don't take it serious what he says. Friends, it's very serious what he says, because what he says is a message, a two-sword message. One is to the West. You know, you have to understand how we think about Israel, and don't mess up with us concerning Israel, and the West doesn't, because nobody stopped to do business with Iran, Europe. I don't know about New Zealand, but Europe and the States, they are still doing business with them. And much more important, the message goes from Ahmadinejad into the Muslim world. He shows them, listen, Israel gets more and more isolated. I can call for the destruction of Israel and nobody really cares. And one thing also we have to understand here is that there's a fight going on in the Islamic world itself. The fight is an old fight between the Shiite and the Sunnite. The Shiite are maybe about 10 to 12% among the Muslims, and the rest are Sunnite, and they always were actually fighting for who has the leadership in the Islamic world. Now, the Saudis are those who are officially the leaders in the Islamic world, because they are the watchmen of the holy sites in Mecca. But and the Shiites were always, until now, until Khomeini appeared, they were the underdogs in the Islamic world. And with Khomeini, things started to change. He was a strong leader, and he was a leader where the Islamic world realized he was able to gain some respect in the West. At least the West started to fear Iran, and that's what is very important. He was a man who the West really was referring to him in a strong way, and he started to get the attention of the Islamic world. Here we have a strong leader. And Ahmadinejad sees himself not only as the successor of Khomeini, but he wants actually to take it further than Khomeini, because he wants simply to become the supreme leader in the Islamic world. And we speak here about 1.5 billion people. To be the leader means to be the one who, at the end, determine what in the Islamic world should happen and what not. And there's only one way to become the supreme leader in the Islamic world today, and all the Muslim leaders knows that. It means the one who is able to solve the shame, who is able to destroy Israel, because Israel is the threat, as I said, to Islamic identity, and the only one who is able to cope with that, to get rid of the source of offense for the Islamic world, will be the supreme leader. And Ahmadinejad is the only leader who dare to stand up in the world and to say officially, I'm going to destroy Israel. And the Muslim world sees he can say that and nobody opposes him. And not only that, he is, in the face of all the world, he's developing the nuclear weapon and nobody opposes him. I mean, sure, there are some resolutions, there are talks, but in the same time, a lot of talks are done and resolutions are issued by the UN. Everybody knows that Europe is doing business with them. Even America, not officially, but there is too much money over there. And we all know that greed always makes blind. And they think, and not only Europe, also the Russians, the Chinese all are doing business with them. And because they are doing business with them, this man can continue to develop his plans, and he does. And he knows the only one who actually could react are the Israelis, but they are bound by the Americans and the Europeans. And the Muslim world understand that. They see there is a strong man rising among us who may become the one who is going to lead us to fulfill the calling of Islam. If you listen to Ahmadinejad, he has only one agenda. And the agenda is we're going to bring the world under submission to Islam. I mean, he invited Bush to convert to Islam because this is the only way to save America. He already issued that to Obama and also to the European leaders. And he really means what he says. He's not insane, this man. By the way, all those who think he's insane, Ahmadinejad is a well-educated man. He was a professor at the university before. He did not come from the street. This man is not stupid. He knows what he does. So, if Ahmadinejad really is not going to be stopped by whoever, this man is already now gaining tremendous support in the Islamic world. Right now, there is a division in the Islamic world between two camps. One camp is the Saudis and Egypt and Jordan, who try to negotiate and who somehow, why do they want the support of the West? Because they fear Ahmadinejad. The Saudis, they know that he's after them. And he makes it very clear. He said, listen, they are unable to lead the Islamic world. They are corrupt. We have to get rid of them. And we should not forget that in the Islamic world, out of 1.5 billion people, there are only 200 million Arabs. More than a billion are non-Arabs. And they identify much more with Ahmadinejad than with the Arabs, with the Saudis. Why? Because the Arabs, over all the centuries, they were very arrogant, even as a leader in Islam. And now the time the non-Arabs in the Islamic world realize that now it's their turn to take the lead in the Islamic world. And here, just a few weeks ago, there were a conference in Qatar where Ahmadinejad and a lot of this nation, like Sudan, Libya, Qatar, and Iraq, and even Lebanon and Iran, they came together and they invited Hamas as representative of Palestine, not Abbas, but Hamas, because Abbas has actually no meaning for them, because he has no power. The man who should be the vis-a-vis for Israel is not taken serious by the Arabs. So this man is gaining more and more authority and strength, not only the nuclear thing, but much more important even is that he's gaining the whole Muslim world coming behind him. And this will become much, much more dangerous. And I'm afraid that in the West, people, the politicians, don't really understand the dynamic, which is gonna bring the West in a very, very difficult situation if we don't have leaders who are clever enough to understand what is going on. You know, in the West, they always try to relate to the Islamic world on a so-called, from a humanistic, democratic perspective. But Islam cannot be dealt from this perspective. That's another logic. It's another understanding. It's another concept of truth, another concept of righteousness, of rights, another concept how to relate to the world. And it's a shame to see there are few who understand, and those who do understand, they're not taken serious. Even the America, they had some good people who understood very well the dynamics, but they were not taken serious because they said, oh, what you say, this is radical, you know, we cannot relate to the Muslims like that, we have to take them, you know, as real partners. That's what they did with Arafat. But Arafat was always talking two languages, one to the West and one to the Muslim world, one in Arabic, where he always said, you know, I'm doing what Muhammad does. It means as long as the enemy is stronger than we are, we're going to try to negotiate in order to get stronger. But the goal was for Arafat always the same. If you would look into the Palestinian Charta, you will see they never changed their goals. And the West accepted that. They did not insist because they were satisfied to see that Arafat was willing to shake hands. And he did, and he received even the Nobel Prize. You can imagine that? Why? Because the West wants to believe. They just want to believe these people are the same as we are. You know, these people, they have changed. There is something good in them. There is something good in Islam. We have to try to get out, to strengthen the goodwill. That's all nonsense. Not because the people are bad or different than the non-Muslims. People are all the same. Muslims and non-Muslims. They have all the same condition. We should not forget. The Bible speaks about mankind, Arab, Kiwis, Americans, Jews. The Bible says the heart of man is evil from the beginning. There's no difference. We all are people who are in need of redemption. But it depends what kind of system we live in. What is the influence, or by what are we driven in our thinking, in our life? And Muslims are driven very clear by a spirit which is not the same as in the West. The West, unfortunately, today is losing deeper and deeper their values, deeper and deeper the foundation they had, the foundation which came out from the Bible. The Judeo-Christian values are diminishing and disappearing in the West more and more. And that's the main problem we face today. Because, and the Muslims, they know that. You know, and coming back, they know because in the West, the Christians, the so-called Christian, they don't have anything they would die for today. Muslims, they tell me sometimes, you know, we are not afraid of the Christian because we would die for our belief. The Christian won't. And friends, and here they, I think, and that's true, we are reminded of the word from Revelation 12:11, where it said, they have overcome the enemy. How? Through the word, through the blood of the Lamb, through the word of their testimony, and they have not loved their life unto death. And that's exactly where Islam come in and the pressure comes in. They know that the people who have no foundation anymore, they would do at the end everything you want, only to save their life. People who are afraid for their life can be corrupted. You can pressure them. People who are afraid for their life, at the end, are a prey to Islam. That's what Osama bin Laden understood. And he understood the West is religiously and morally so corrupt, there is no substance anymore. He said, we're going to invade them because they have nothing to stand against us. And that's exactly what happens in the West. The strategy and the fear is not primarily that Islam is invading the West, but there's nothing to resist. If you look into the society, I don't know so much about New Zealand. May God really give it that you are in a better place than Europe. But I know Europe very well, and I can tell you, Europe is spiritually on a very low place. Very low place. That's why Europe is so threatened by Islam. And why Europe has nothing to stand against Islam. And Europe is more and more opening the doors. Not because they like Islam, or because they really believe Islam is good, but because they have nothing to confront Islam with. The only thing which counts is they would do everything to survive. Instead of, or let's say that individualism, egoism, and the concern for my own rights, for my own life, it's so strong in Europe that they have a lot to lose. And the Islam knows that. And that's why actually everyone, not only in Europe, but everyone who is afraid for his life is a prey to Islam. And Muslims respect only those they understand. They are not afraid to die for what they believe. They are not easily to be corrupted only because you threaten them or you attack them. But they have seen that the Western government are more and more pressured and corrupted by the threat of terror. And terror will not diminish, terror will continue to grow, even in the West, because the more the Islamic spirit gets through terror, the more it gets hungry. And I'm not expecting that terrorism actually to disappear in the West, but to grow. Even everybody believe and think that the world has now a new Messiah who is going to put an end to all that. And you would not believe it when before Obama was elected, he really was called a Messiah in Europe. And let's pray, you know, I'm not one who would call Obama the emerging Antichrist, only God knows his heart. And my prayer is, God, who, whatever this man may think, whoever he is, you sits on the throne, use him, please, for your plans. But on the other hand, we have also to say, looking at Obama, he's a very scary man. He's very clever. If you see how he puts his government together, very, very clever. And there was no president before him who had the ability to integrate actually the sympathy of the world on him, to integrate and also to attract all the sympathy, because very simply, Asian, Africa, they identify with him because he represents them. He's the first non-white supreme leader in the West. And he broke actually the stigma that only the white people had, could reach this peak of power in the West. So they identify because he gives dignity to all those who identify with him. But not only Africa and Asia see Obama as their symbol for freedom. Europeans, they call him Messiah. Why? Because he is the humanist. He can speak amazingly. He was elected without having any real agenda. He didn't do anything before. He had only good words. And everybody believed him. He had no experience, nothing. But everybody believed that he is the answer. Only because he said, yes, we can. But something else in Europe, which is playing into that, not only that he spoke so well that he is an humanist, but in Europe, you would not dare to question somebody like Obama, because if you would question him, then you may end up be called a racist. So this card plays in Europe very strong. And who wants to be called a racist? The Muslim world, they hope, and they also identify with Obama, and they hope one day he will remember that his second name is Hussein. I don't think that Obama himself sees himself as a Muslim, but the Muslim world identify with him because they say, we're going to remind him that where his roots are. And even Israel puts a lot of hope in Obama, not because his name is Barak. This could be also a tool, but it's not because his name is Barak, but Israel always is very, very attracted to people who are humanistic. Israel is a very humanistic nation. Humanism is very strong. People like Peres, they adore Obama. That's one spirit to the other. That's what. And so they think Obama is better for us than Bush, because he knows how to speak to the Muslims. He knows how to speak to the world. As a man who is not so narrow-minded. I mean, Bush was a good friend of Israel, obviously, but he was a little bit too narrow-minded. You know, these evangelical Christians who sometimes just scare two-thirds of the world off. I mean, we liked Bush, but he was a little bit too radical in his belief. But Obama, he's open for everything. Open for everything. So Here we are coming into a time, friends, very, very exciting on one hand and very challenging time. No man had the opportunity and the ability and the power like Obama really to change the world order, because he has the influence. People will listen to him. We will see. But concerning Israel, I believe there's no other man who had the power and the ability to put pressure on Israel like he will be able to do that. He's very friendly right now, very friendly. And even he called Peres to congratulate for this expression of democracy in Israel. And I'm not sure how long this attitude gonna stay, when Israel, maybe, let's say, Netanyahu is gonna be the prime minister and he's not gonna be willing to divide Jerusalem, for instance. This will be the key question. How much of this friendly attitude is gonna remain towards Israel? When Israel gonna, under hopefully strong prime minister, gonna be stubborn in this question? Because everything is gonna come back to this question, Jerusalem. Who is gonna, at the end, rule over Jerusalem? And the Muslim world is not willing to give in this question. Every Muslim leader who gives a talk refers to Jerusalem. Not only Osama bin Laden, everyone comes back to Jerusalem. And because without Jerusalem, there's no peace. Every Muslim leader would tell you that. And now we are heading more and more towards the reality that Europe, out of fear for the increasing terror, out of fear that the Muslim world would get really angry over Europe, they're going to decide what to do with Israel. Because the Islamic world, and especially terrorism, they have two actually requests. The two requests are this. They say, if you want to be our friends, if you don't want to continue to provoke Islamic dignity, if you really want to express that we are respected, that you take us serious, then show it in helping us to get rid of the two main source of conflict, two main source of offense for the Muslim world. And what are the two main sources? One thing we all agree is Israel. The second thing is, you wouldn't believe, but it will come stronger and stronger. The second thing, which is a source of offense and conflict for the Muslim world, are the believing Christian. Why? Because if the believing Christian really believe what they believe, that there's no way than Yeshua, he's the only truth, if you say he's the only truth, then you express that everything else is a lie. Then you would say Islam is not a religion of peace. It's not the same as Judaism and Christianity, only with some cultural differences. Then you would say Islam is a dead end. And if you would say Islam is a dead end, it's a lie. Muhammad is not a prophet. This is an offense to Islam. How can you say you respect Islam and at the same time evangelize Muslim? Because evangelizing Muslims means you tell them, listen, what you believe is not living to life. You know, you're going to be lost if you stay in Islam. Islam is not giving eternal life. It's a lie. So you are actually an enemy of Islam. In Islamic thinking, you are corrupting Muslims. You are corrupting Muslim and turning true believer into infidels. And according to the Sharia, this is worse than killing and murder. So, more and more, when Islam starts to gain influence in the West, and the West want to cooperate, to coexistence with Islam, they're going to start, not only in the Muslim world, but in the West, to say, listen, to the governments, how can you allow Christian to do mission among Muslims, to proselyte among Muslims? How can you allow that, knowing that this is going to cause conflict? Because it's an offense for us if they come and start to evangelize, because a Muslim would say, we don't do that. And that's true. Muslims are not interested in conversion of individuals. They are not interested in the individuals. Why? Because Islam, redemption is not a question in Islam. Islam, it's always about territories and about rulership, but not about personal redemption. Islam wants to bring under submission and not to make somebody, and it's, by the way, it's very easy to become a Muslim. You have only to say three times the Shahada. It means the Islamic statement of faith, where you say three times, I believe there's only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. I believe there's only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. You say that three times, then you're a Muslim. You have to say that in front of a witness, and then you are a Muslim. From then on, you cannot turn back if somebody has witnessed that. But it's not about personal conversion or personal redemption. It's always about rulership and territory. And all those who live under territory of Islam, they are Muslims. So they say, we don't do mission. Yes, we invite people. In the West, they say, we invite people to be Muslims because they are naturally Muslims. They have only to discover who they are, and they will see that Islam is the only true and supreme religion. But you, Christian, what you do is you turn actually the hearts of the people, their thinking. You corrupt their thinking, their understanding of God into something else. So they say, please, in order to avoid conflict between us and you, you have to forbid mission among Muslims. They don't say you have to forbid missions because we don't like it. They say, you have to do that because you don't want more conflicts between Muslim and non-Muslims. You don't want more tension. So, please, and this will come, friends, in Europe, where Muslims are going to request the governments to order laws against mission among Muslims. Because it's an offense. In the Islamic world, it's forbidden anyway. And here, the West is on a place where they have nothing to stand up against, because foundation in the West, the Christian foundation, are more and more diminishing. Humanism has no answer. So they would say, why should actually Christian to be allowed to do, to cause permanent conflict and to make it impossible to coexistence with this different religion and culture? Why should Christian, who are anyway a source of conflict with their stubborn, intolerant understanding, there's only one truth, there's only one way. You understand how Islam is playing into this emptiness of the West? Because they know they can start to be strong and to voice their request, because the West has nothing to stand against. And I'm afraid that the Christian in the West do not really realize where we are today and what we are running into. We may find ourselves very, very soon in a very uncomfortable situation as believing Christian. In our own society, being seen as a source of conflict, as those who are a threat to the society because of their belief, because they believe something which is unacceptable for a big part of the society. In early years, maybe believers were not taken serious, but more and more they're going to be taken serious, because the Muslims say, these people are an offense to us. Forbid them to do what they do. And then we have to make a choice. Are we really willing to obey the Lord who sent us to preach the gospel? Or are we going to be quiet because we are afraid for our own skin? It's also a part of Islamic strategy, because they know they can play both cards. One, to push the West, to push the button of anti-Semitism in telling the West, Israel is actually responsible for our anger and for the threat over your life, and the Christian missionaries are also responsible for our anger. And if you don't do something here, you're going to taste our anger, and it's going to grow. I don't want to scare you, but it's a fact. That's where we are heading to today. So, Ken said 5 minutes before, but I have the feeling that some look at me already with things started to come out of their ears, so maybe it's good to stop here and to continue tonight.